Let's begin with a word of prayer. And this is a prayer from the Cranberry Book. For those seeking deeper knowledge of God. So that would fit today, I think. Let's pray. Gracious and holy God, give us diligence to seek you, wisdom to perceive you, patience to wait for you. Grant us, O God, a mind to meditate, eyes to behold, ears to listen, a heart to love, and a life to proclaim, through the power of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, our Savior and Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Welcome. Thanks for coming today on Monday morning. My name is Ron Rood, and I'll be leading the Bible studies this week. And there's some great classes that have been prepared, and I've gotten to know some of the staff this week. Martine is here, who's going to be doing one later on, and Micah, I saw Micah. Yeah? And anybody else that's going to be leading the class? Catherine? Yes, so we all try to take advantage of what we can, but we also have to hike and take naps and things like that. So, you asked about a barber. My dad cut our hair when I was a kid, and of course, he did a terrible job, we thought. But I think I learned a little bit. So on Monday mornings, I give haircuts to homeless men. I don't do women. I'm not good enough for that. About a dozen or so every Monday morning, and been doing it for about 3 years. And it's just kind of a neat way to be connected with humanity. So I get to practice my barbering. I tell them I'm not a professional. No mirrors are allowed. And it's free. So if that's okay with you, here we go. Our theme for this year is in 1 Peter, like good stewards of the many-colored grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. And many-colored is a certain nuanced translation, apparently, of the word for manifold grace of God. And it's kind of one of those phrases that opens up our minds and hearts to think more creatively. The Bible study, we're going to have it in 5 sessions. Today, kind of looking at creation and this amazing world that God has made. Tomorrow, looking at the fall and asking the question, are those stories talking about something original or recent? And then third, the Egyptian Exodus kind of story and the story of Israel. The fourth day, looking at what is Jesus about? What is that? Why Jesus? And then the fifth day, thinking about Jesus' way of being in the world as opposed to other ways that we have as options. So that's kind of the flow of the week here. The study this week is based on a book that I wrote and was published in 2010. It reflects my journey of the last decade or so. And rethinking Christianity. That's what I'm doing. And I think a lot of people are in our world. There are some things that don't work for me anymore. And I'm finding different ways to think about what the story of life is and what the story of Jesus is. And these are available in the Holy Bookstore, and I've brought a few copies myself too. And I hope to not have to carry him home. So, a lot of my journey has been exploring the relationship between science and Christian theology. I was a humanities person in college. I went to Gustavus Adolphus College. Anybody heard of that or been there? Okay. And I started out as a music major. Thought I wanted to either be a band director or a rock and roll drummer. I was in a rock and roll band in high school and college, And we thought we were really good, because we could play loud. Then we started to have girlfriends, it was all guys. And they didn't think we were that good. So I had to kind of readjust. But when I started to feel the call to ministry and to go to seminary, I was able to put together what was called a distributed major, which was basically five minors: history, philosophy, psychology, religion, and music. My advisor thought to have a background in the human condition would be a good thing for ministry, and it certainly is and was. But in my journey, the last 15 years or so, I've really become interested in the other sciences, evolutionary biology and geology and astronomy. And it's just opened up my world. The image that I think of is I've been fishing on one side of the boat for most of my life and caught a few perch and maybe a walleye here and there and an old shoe once in a while. And now I've been casting my net on the other side of the boat into the deep. Science is kind of doing that for me. And I have so many fish in these nets now that my theological nets are starting to tear. And it's exciting. It's exciting. So that's a little bit about my journey there. We're going to look at God's evolving story of life today. Eden was good, not perfect. I'll say a little bit more about that later on. So, God's story of life, it just kind of opened up some things. Things are not always what they seem. So, what's the highest mountain in the world? K2? Everest. If you go from sea level to the top of the mountain, if you go from the bottom of the ocean to the top of the mountain, it's Mauna Kea in Hawaii. If you go from the center of the Earth's core to the top of the mountain, it's Mount Chimborazo in Ecuador, because the Earth is fatter at the equator, so there's a greater distance. What's the largest river in the world? Yeah, the Nile is the longest, but the Amazon is the largest. In fact, it averages between 1 and 6 miles wide. 20% of all the water that leaves from a river that goes into an ocean on this planet is from the Amazon. It's huge, huge. So a cheetah can run 60 miles an hour, and one of their main meals is a gazelle that can run 40 miles an hour. So, who wins?
Gazelle. It depends on the distance.
Yeah. A cheetah can run 60 miles an hour for 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Then it is exhausted. I mean, on the edge exhausted. And if it doesn't catch their lunch, they probably won't eat for a day or two. Or they may be so tired that if another animal takes away what they have caught, they really don't fight back. A gazelle can run forever, a little slower. A cheetah runs only straight. A gazelle likes to go this way and that way and this way. So things are not always what they seem in God's evolving story of life. It's just amazing the more you learn, and we're up here now in Holden Village, and there's a little kid trying to catch the chipmunks as I was walking down. We lived in Colorado for a while, and that was part of my journey too. And I was surprised and fascinated to learn that the Rocky Mountain system that we see today is the fourth mountain range that has risen up and eroded down. This one began about 70 million years ago. Anybody been to Red Rocks? Or the Garden of the Gods? That's sedimentary rock that was buried a mile under the ground from a previous mountain range that when this recent range lifted up, it exposed it to the surface. And so you see these red rocks. Dinosaur Ridge is outside of Denver in Morrison, Colorado. And about 120 million years ago, there were a bunch of dinosaurs walking through a riverbed with big feet. And they left tracks that became filled in with sediment and fossilized and were buried under a mile of sediment from the previous time. And then when this latest mountain range started to arise, it pushed it up and exposed it. So now you can go to Morrison, Minnesota and see this slanted rock hillside with dinosaur tracks there. You can go and touch them. What an amazing thing. And a lot of dinosaur bones too have been found in that area. And then if you look out at the stars, anybody done that since they've been here? It's so incredible. It's so incredible how vast God's universe is. If we look out at the stars at night, we're basically looking at our own galaxy, the Milky Way, which has a couple hundred billion stars. The nearest star to us is Proxima Centauri, 4.2 light years away. What does that mean? If you go the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, or 670 million miles an hour, it'll take 4.2 years to get there. That's the nearest star. To get an idea of how far away that nearest star is, the astronauts took 3 days to get to the moon. 3 days. 240,000 miles. How long do you think it would take to get to the nearest star to ours? 800,000 years. That's the nearest star. And then it goes out from there into our galaxy. And then that's only one galaxy. The nearest galaxy to ours is Andromeda, 2.5 million light years away. And then there are a couple hundred billion galaxies. So why is God's universe so vast? And not only is it vast, but it's also ancient. Anybody see the moon eclipse on December 21st? The lunar eclipse. My wife and I slept out on the roof. We live in Tucson, Arizona, that night. And we could every once in a while open our eyes while we were sleeping and see the lunar eclipse. And for some reason, the coyotes were really... We always hear coyotes at night, but they were sounding different that night. I don't know what was going on. But ancient, this universe. So you know how it works. If we were to step outside now and look at the sun, which is 93 million miles away, we would not be seeing what the sun looks like right now. We would be seeing how it looked 8 minutes ago. That's how long it took for that light image to get here. And the nearest star, we would know what it's like 4.2 years ago. And the nearest galaxy, we don't know what it looks like today. We only know what it looks like 2.5 million years ago when someone pushed the send button and sent that image to Earth. And astronomers can look 13 billion years away. So really, we're looking back in time. Astronomers are looking at galaxies that we don't even know if they're around anymore. But we can see what they look like 13 billion years ago. So God's universe is vast and it is ancient. The Father's house has many dwelling places. In the Father's house, the Creator's house, is every place where the reign of God is. And the reign of God is heaven, yes, but it's also the whole universe, including planet Earth. and it has many, many dwelling places. We're the third rock from the sun there. The first four planets are rock. The next ones are gas, mostly. So if you step on them, there's no hard surface. But it's just amazing, and that's one little solar system. And it's only recently that scientists have figured out that these stars that we see in the sky are actually other suns with planets evolving around them. And it's only in the past few hundred years. We used to think that there was our sun and our Earth, and then there's a bunch of lights up there. Well, those are suns and solar systems. So it's pretty amazing. The story of life. The universe began about 13.7 billion years ago. Whoa! Our own planet about 4.6 billion years ago. Life emerged here about 3.8 billion years ago. Single cell life. And it took over 3 billion years for single cell life to evolve into multiple cell life. So that must have been a major change in this story. But 395 million years, sea life moved on to land, reptiles and dinosaurs came. Mammals about 195 million years ago, that's what we are, mammals. 50 million years ago, I just learned this in the past few years. I just found this fascinating. Have you ever wondered why there are mammals in the ocean? How did they get there? Well, about 50 million years ago, some mammals living along the water's edge began to evolve back into the ocean. There must have been more food sources. So, hippopotamus and beluga whales share very similar bone structure and DNA. And somehow the breathing apparatus from the nose evolved over about 10 million years so that it's in the back of the head. And minks and ferrets share DNA with otters. And wolves share DNA with seals. And cattle with manatees. And these are mammals in the ocean. They have live births. When a whale has a baby, the first breath is the whale swims to the surface and goes, and then goes back down. Some whales can be underwater for about an hour, but they have to come back for a breath. I just find that fascinating. Primates, about 20 million years ago, the word primates means primary. A primate came up with that word. We like to think of ourselves as primary. Our predecessor species, Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, began emerging 3 to 4 million years ago. Some of them used fire for cooking, for shelter, for home. Homo sapiens, that's what we are, began to emerge a couple hundred thousand years ago. And modern Homo sapiens, about 70,000 years ago. So God's story of life is vast, and God's story of life is ancient. The subtitle of this talk is Eden was Tov, or good, not perfect. I got this insight from Daniel Erlander's book, Manna and Mercy. Anybody read that? Wonderful book. Get that book. But God made everything, the Genesis 1 story. God made everything, and behold, it was good. Tov. Good. Tov. And the idea of perfection actually is a later Greek and Roman construct that was imposed onto the Hebrew worldview. That's not how the Hebrews thought. So there was never a perfect time, I don't think. God made the world tov. The word utopia, that's a Greek word. Topia means place. U means no. The word utopia or utopia means no place. And no place has never existed. God made the world tov. And tov means many things. It includes green scenes of towering trees, and we're seeing that here at Olney. Rippled streams flowing with insects and fish. Mountain peaks grinning fall-colored reflections on mirrored lakes. We hiked to Holden Lake yesterday. We saw that. Berries and wild greens. Heavy rains dimpling deep forested backwaters. Tenacious snow patches blanketing giant boulders. And wonderful sounds of squawking, chittering, chattering, growling, prattling, garish, and noisy life. Eden also includes rain and wind and seasons and fungi and earthquakes. God made the world with earthquakes. If we didn't have earthquakes, this would be a dead planet. No life would be here. It's part of a huge circulation system. So molten stuff comes to the surface and it interacts with the sun, energy from the sun and atmosphere and various elements, and then it goes back down under and brings things down there. It's a huge circulation system that makes our planet alive. Planets that don't have this are dead planets. So God made the world with earthquakes. If it hits you, it's a bad thing. But it's good for God's story of life. Eden includes termites, snow and ice, uplift and erosion, lightning. Lightning recharges the atmosphere with nitrogen and the soil and other elements. If it hits you, it's a bad thing, but God made the world with lightning. Benjamin Franklin, who lived in the 1700s, he invented the lightning rod, among other things. And that allowed lightning to hit your house, but not burn it down. And Franklin was criticized by some religious people who thought he was messing with God's messaging system, God's texting system. Eden includes photosynthesis. Hurricanes distribute the accumulated hot air around the equator belt to other parts of the globe. If it hits you, it's a bad thing, or your town. But God made the world with hurricanes. Eden includes evaporation, conductivity, bacteria. You and I are filled with bacteria inside of us. Millions of species, and on us, we have kind of co-evolved together. They need us, we need them. If we didn't have that, we would die like that. We like to sanitize our hands with those. Of the several billion bacteria on me, that gets rid of about 40 of them. I guess it's okay to do, but bacteria is part of life. Seasons. The food network, or food chain, or food cycle, however you want to see it. At first, ecologists studied food chains, big fish eating little fish. Quickly, they realized that since big fish die and are subsequently eaten by scavengers and microbes that are then eaten by still other organisms, it is more appropriate to speak of food cycles, or webs. Further analysis yielded the insight that all of nature is continually engaged in a recycling of energy and matter. And there are various kinds of cycles going on all the time. Eden includes volcanoes, sex, conductivity, youth, middle age, old age, viruses, forest fires, life, and death. These guys here are called gamble quail. They're in Arizona. And every spring, mom and dad will have about 14 little babies, and they're precocial, meaning that as soon as they're born, they get up and start running around. They don't have to stay in a nest and be fed or anything. So of those 14 babies, about 11 of them will be lunch or breakfast or dinner for another creature. About 3 of them will grow up and have babies themselves. What if all 14 have babies? Or what if none of them ever died? We would have a lot of gamble quail in our world. And you can say that about every single species, including our own. So it took about 200,000 years for our species to reach the mark of 1.5 billion Homo sapiens. 1901, Teddy Roosevelt became president after McKinley was shot. 1.5 billion. It took 60 years to double that. When John Kennedy became president in 61. It's taken 50 years to more than double it to today. It's 6.9 billion Homo sapiens. The near future, 9 billion by the year 2050, 13 billion by this century's end. I don't think the community of life can stand that many of us. And I don't think we can stand that many of each other. But it's not just numbers. It also has to do with our footprint in this earth. And you and I live in a culture that consumes and pollutes 8 times the world's average. So my wife and I, we have 2 daughters, they're grown now. So we're a family of 4. 4 times 8. Really, we're a family of 32. So what would you think of us if Nancy and I had 30 kids? And what would you think of us if we lived in a neighborhood where everyone averaged 30 kids? And lived in a state or a nation? Start to wonder. But what if humans never died? Then we would really have a lot of us creatures running around this earth. So Eden includes life and death, I believe. God made it that way. And death is different than perishing. I'm going to talk about that on another day. And I don't think Jesus came to overcome death. I think Jesus came to overcome perishing. And we'll take a look at that on another day. The earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof. In the Father's house there are many, many dwelling places. The reign of God has been going on for a long time, and it is vast, and it is ancient, and we get to be a part of that. There's one species among 20 million on this planet. There's one planet among jillions in this universe. So what about Homo sapiens? I said that our predecessor species started to come about 3 to 4 million years ago. Homo sapiens. Sapiens means wise. Guess who came up with that word? Modern Homo sapiens, sapiens. Guess who came up with that word? I think it was a biologist, Linné, Swedish biologist. So the human creature, let's just think about that a little bit. As you know, there are 2 creation stories in Genesis. Genesis 2 is actually the older one, about 900 BCE. And then Genesis 1 is the more recent one, about 500 BCE. And in that creation story, then Yahweh formed the Adam, the human creature, from the dust of the Adamah, the soil. We are made from the soil. We are made from the earth. We are earthlings. We are made from the dirt. We are dirtlings. We are made from the soil. This picture is from the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. Anybody ever been there? It's a wonderful museum. They have an exhibit called Underground Adventure, where they've taken like a square yard of soil and then blown it up 1,000 times. So you walk through rooms and everything's larger than life. So a worm that is normally 2 inches long is 10 feet long. And a little mite that is microscopic is, you know, this big. And you just see all the life in the soil. Millions of species in just a handful of soil. And we are made from that. Martin Brokenleg was a professor at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. And I think he's now at the Vancouver School of Theology. He's Lakota. And I heard him speak once, and he said, you know, when I feel kind of out of sorts and discombobulated, in a state of existential disrepair, I like that phrase, rather than turn on the TV or even go to a counselor, I lay down on the ground. And it's not particularly spiritual, it's just being in the midst of all of this life, this soil. And I thought, there's something to that. That's where we come from. That's what we're made of. And we return to the soil, too. Except in our culture. We put people in a steel casket and a cement vault. I have no idea what that's about. My family has, you know, instructions or suggestions that I want to be in a wood box and I want to decompose. I want to return to the earth. I want to return, and that's the life and death cycle is the way God made the world. If it wasn't for bacteria, you know, reducing things that die, there wouldn't be new life again. And we're kind of a death-denying culture, and others are too. Even my wife wants to be cremated. You know, I don't know if there's as much nutrition for the soil in ashes as there is in decomposition. I don't know. But we are made from the soil. And then Genesis 1 is the earlier creation story, about 500 BCE. And there's a phrase in that story that the storyteller puts in the mouth of God. On the sixth day, God had made all of these creatures, all of these things. And then it says, and God said, let us make humankind in our image. And people have always wondered, well, who's us and who's our? And who's God talking to? And I learned in seminary, well, us might be the Trinity or some kind of royal court in heaven or something. Here's what I think. I think God was talking to the animals and the creatures he had just made. Let us make humankind in our image. And we are made in the image of God and in the image of all of the creatures. And we forget either at our peril. Now, the problem is, we've forgotten one or the other or both. Now, I happen to believe that all creatures are made in the image of God and in the image of all of their creatures. I don't know if that's what the biblical writers were thinking. I have no idea. But both Genesis 1 and 2, if you think about it in these ways, really fits into evolutionary biology. Really fits. And I think it's pretty exciting. Humans are one of the 20 million species on the planet. And we're really developed in some ways and underdeveloped in other ways. We can't fly or live under the sea. We're clumsy on our feet compared to a mountain goat or a mule. We have terrible hand-eye coordination compared to a squirrel. We rank in the middle in terms of speed, faster than cows, slower than pumas. We cannot change color like a chameleon, fish, or tree toad. We cannot store water like a desert tortoise, sorrel cactus, or Bactrian camel. So we have a lot of abilities, but other creatures do too. And each creature's job is to be that creature. Our species, as I mentioned, emerged about 200,000 years ago. We think around in Africa. About 150,000 years ago, it migrated throughout the African continent into the Fertile Crescent in southern Asia about 80,000 years ago. Southern Europe and the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, so forth, about 60,000 years ago, and then another wave, 40,000, another wave, 10,000 years ago. Australia and the Oceanic Islands, again in waves, about 65,000, 30,000, 10,000 years ago. Into China, about 40,000. And into the Americas, perhaps as early as 25,000 years ago. So you've maybe seen some of those maps that kind of show how our species spread around. And they can track that by analyzing DNA and diseases and head lice and certain viruses that only are in humans. And it's different for male and different for female. And it's just amazing. The migrations were prompted by climate, volatility, the ice ages, animal droughts, food requirements, explorations, economics, natural wanderings. And the waves were not just one way, but it was back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And over a long period of time, you can just kind of see how that has happened. And of course, numerous new species have come on the scene since we got here. So God's evolving story of life, the reign of God, is vast. The reign of God is old. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. In the mother's house there are many, many dwelling places. And we get to have a few of them as one species. There's great diversity in God's garden of life. A Himalayan yak must live differently than a Costa Rican iguana. An African termite can't expect to survive using beluga whale life skills. Gila woodpeckers and Mariposa lilies have different needs from those of the species Homo sapiens, Pacific leatherback sea turtles, or 1,500-year-old bristlecone pine trees. Anybody seen the bristlecones in the Rocky Mountains? They can live.
And in the Sierra Nevada.
Them there too, huh?
In the Sierra Nevada mountains, yeah. Also.
And they live for, I've heard up to 4,000 years, but I mean, just incredible. And unlike other evolving mammals, which give live birth to fully formed babies, marsupials, such as the kangaroo and koala bear, deliver bean-sized offspring that then crawl back into the mother's pouch for a couple of months for further nursing and safety before taken on the world. There's great diversity. And there's great diversity among our species, too. There are tens of thousands of ways to be human, including a variety of economic systems, religious and philosophical creeds, sexual roles, gender identities, and family structures. A way of life for one culture may involve hunting and fishing, and for another, eating edible gourds and wild berries. Certain environments coax some people to plant vegetables and hunt large mammals and erect buildings, and others to harvest wild grains and domesticate animals like llamas, cows, and chickens. Nomadic people live in the lowlands during the winter and in the upper altitudes through summer. Most cultures lean towards patriarchal expressions of authority and lineage, but others lean towards matriarchy. Whatever is normative for one group depends on how well their way of living complements God's garden and their locale. When it doesn't, they move on or die out. There's great diversity in this vast and ancient story of life. So here's a question for us to just think about a little bit. As you think about this, what questions arise in you? What do you find fascinating, puzzling, or faith-inspiring? Let's just kind of share a little bit. What's going on inside you? Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering about other planets, if there is life, what do they view as religion? I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah. What do you think? Life on other planets, what do you think?
Well, if there is life, what would they view as a religion? Would they have our religion? Like, has God sent like a messenger like Jesus or Jesus himself
right.
in a different image to their planets? Or
right.
what's happened there?
Has anybody else wondered that kind of question?
Yes.
That's a great question. The elements of life seem to be throughout the universe. I think there's life all over the universe. I personally don't think we'll ever know though, because as I mentioned, it's a long ways.
Yeah.
We're never going to get there.
Yeah.
If the dying out of things is natural part of life, the cultures don't make it because they don't fit in with creation, is it really our job to make sure creatures continue to survive? And that's just purely coming up off your...
Right.
You know, this is not beliefs one way or the other, but it's like, okay, puzzling,
right.
This is where I'm coming from. Because we are so concerned making sure all species continue. He said, obviously, in your storyline here.
There have been extinctions, and there have been mass extinctions.
Right. And so that's just a response, I guess, is
what right. At the Field Museum of Natural History, and I've seen this other places too, it's normal for 5 to 10 species a year to become extinct. And we will one day. However, in the last several decades, according to a display at this museum and other places, currently, 80 species a day are going extinct because of human behavior. Is that natural? I guess I would question whether it is. But it's a big question. And you kind of expressed that we're so concerned that they don't go extinct. Well,
one here and one there, but
right.
obviously if we're losing 80 a day,
yeah.
we're concerned about except one day out there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's scary.
We're also in that same vein. We're also so concerned about human beings living forever.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend so much on health care
mm-hmm.
and exotic medicines.
Yeah.
Is that really appropriate?
Right. And our health care system is really for the rich. Mm-hmm. Me, I have insurance. Yeah.
Make an argument that you should let survival the fittest for people and feel good about that? That people should just die and never take medicine?
Some people do.
Or what is an appropriate amount of medicine, and what is, like, if they spend $1 million keeping me alive an extra 6 months, is that stewardship? Is that good stewardship? Those are huge questions. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking, you said something about adapting or dying out, and my husband's Rotary group is aiding a tribe in Ethiopia mm-hmm. who have been nomadic.
Mm-hmm.
There's no land anymore to become, nomadic, so they know nothing about clean water and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And several thousand people who are dying.
Yeah.
And they're, bringing water, and the difficulty of them just understanding that you need to remove yourself, for toilet away from water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just am amazed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're working so hard to save these people.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's so many numbers of us.
Yeah.
But what is the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned survival of the fittest. As I understand evolving life, survival of the fittest, and Darwin never used that phrase. It was Herbert Spencer came up with that. I think of it more of as survival of those species that fit in. Into a world that's always changing.
And I was thinking, if you bring it back home, there are some kids that are actually born with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's mostly caused by our actions or inactions,
mm-hmm.
living close to a transition station or a dump, a nuclear dump, not living too far away from it.
Right.
And so you see a child that is born, and the doctor works so hard to take care of that child, or to make sure they survive. The question is, should the doctor spend $1 million to save that kid?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, yes. That's what makes us human. We separate us from animals.
Mm. Yeah.
I would just comment. I actually work for a large drug company.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that it seems like is the $1 million we talk about to save somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's employment for people. That's
mm-hmm.
it's not actually $1 million worth of resources. Like, you're not wasting, $1 million worth of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's research and coming up with the biology and the technology.
Mm-hmm.
to save someone. So in that sense, it's not so wasteful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
It's interesting that your projections show a continuing population, sort of an exponential curve.
Yeah.
There's a finite... We have finite resources,
right.
Water,
right.
The air we
right.
breathe, everything is, there's a limit to, so when are we done? When do we stop with the population growth?
Right.
It seems intuitive that it can't go on forever.
Right.
And
90% of the resources in the world go to 10% of the people. That's us.
How much of the population growth, though, is communities that are, living nomadic lifestyles, living primitive agricultural lifestyles, suddenly you improve sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
The rate of death of young children are not dying from dysentery and cholera and all these easy diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So family systems where you had 10 children because you knew 7 of them probably weren't going to make it to adulthood. Now suddenly you've got 7 making it to adulthood. And then as these communities mature, the birth rate goes down. I mean, we've seen it in China. We've seen it in, you know, in many developed countries, the birth rate is actually less than replacement. So, you know, I keep thinking about, with productivity increasing, we talk about that this can't go on, but at the same time, if we can help these developing countries, they will figure out that, okay, I don't need to have 14 children to be secure in my old age. It, to me, it's like God's plan is you need to help each other. I mean, we're kind of wired for that. And if we keep spreading out and we keep improving sanitation and we keep improving people's life, eventually we'll get to whatever that proper level carrying capacity is, because with productivity, one farmer can feed thousands of people. The problem is that the political systems concentrate that wealth in a few people while thousands of their subjects are starving. Mm-hmm. And if we can just get more equitable in how things are distributed, things are going to work out. I mean, we can't just focus on, oh my God, there's too many people and we can't. Mm-hmm. Right. You're right. If we keep concentrating wealth, we can't do it. But if we follow God's plan, and as Jesus said, share, we can do this. There's no reason we can't have a world full of people who are fulfilled. We just have to work on it.
And it becomes more and more critical that we do follow God's plan.
Right.
Yeah.
I was thinking that we are here to help other species, because we do have the power. We have the brain power and the mental power to think of all these cures, so we should be helping each other. But I think what my dad said was right, that we don't need to just concentrate it, we need to spread it out. But just help the people around us before we spread out more.
Right. So God's evolving story of life, we'll kind of wrap up here, is vast, is ancient. The earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof. God's house has many dwelling places. All kinds of creatures. These are creatures that use tools. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide the people with grain, for so you have prepared. The pastures of the wilderness overflow. The hills gird themselves with joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valleys deck themselves. How do you deck yourself? with grain. They shout and sing together for joy. I mean, look at how complex that tiny creature is that God has made. I wonder what this creature is thinking.
Kind of scary.
So here's some Bible passages to look at tonight for tomorrow's study. Genesis 3 through 6. And John 14, 1 through 6. And here's some questions to think about this afternoon and tonight. And this is sort of the fall story, and in those chapters are what I think is the saddest verse in the Bible. And see if you can find that. The saddest verse in the Bible. So here are some questions to think about for tomorrow. One. Why do you think Judaism and Christianity are so recent? Look at that. 2. Why do you think the message of both the Old Testament and New Testament is the kingdom of God or the reign of God? That this is the Lord's world. And 3, why do you think it's addressed to our species? Those are the questions to think about tomorrow. For the month. And as I said, a lot of this stuff is coming out of this book. If you're interested in a copy, just speak to me. And
could you go back to the question?
Yes.
Did you say how is it addressed to Homo sapiens or
why? Why is it addressed to Homo sapiens?
Okay.
Who live on planet Earth.
Okay.
And tomorrow we'll be looking at the fall stories and thinking about them in some ways that have been rolling around in my mind. And what it says about our species and our place in the Father's house, in God's house with the many dwelling places. Where do we fit in? Okay, any final insights or comments or anything?
Very evocative. Very evocative.
Good. Hope it generates thoughts and conversation.